Today, more on the secrets hidden in the walls of Broughton Castle.
There was clearly an arch there, some kind of window or entrance hall there. What's all this about? What did that go to?
Using geophysics to uncover what could be a long-lost Roman building in Dorset.
And how you can use maps to help trace your own family tree.
Yes, hello and welcome to the Time Team podcast with Helen Geek and Martin Williams. And yes, if you enjoy researching your own family's connection to the past, then make sure you stick around to the end of the podcast. You're going to meet Mark from The Genealogist, who'll be demonstrating how you can learn even more through some unique tools that he's developed. That is coming up a little bit later. But first, I saw you on BBC Breakfast Sofa the other day, Helen.
Yes, you did. You did. Tony Robinson and I were there. We were chatting about the amazing interest that there's been in our revelation about the relationship between the two bodies discovered at the princely burial site at Cherington. So you heard it first here on the Time Team podcast that our DNA analysis has shown that the teenage girl and the young boy were sister and brother, and it's very likely that they died at the same time. And I am so pleased that it's getting wide attention because it really is a huge breakthrough in our understanding of family relationships in the early Anglo-Saxon period. Families are such a massive part of human culture, aren't they? And until now, we have known from the historical record that children, particularly upper-class children, were often fostered away from home, either because a parent had died or just as part of their education. So we've all always said, don't read too much into, say, skeletons with similar genetic traits like missing teeth and so on. But now we've got actual hard data on real relationships, and it's going to mean we have to rethink our ideas.
It's just so interesting. Time Team's Jackie McKinley was instrumental in bringing that news to us, of course. And Jackie's actually recorded a bonus episode of the podcast with Helen. It's available for all Time Team members to listen to via Patreon. There for you right now, patreon.com/timeteamofficial, where you can also hear ad-free versions of this podcast.
And the other thing, of course, is that it does really pull us up short, realising that here was a family that had lost two children at the same time. Now, I can't imagine how awful it would be to lose one child, let alone two at once. It must have seemed incredibly unfair. And if you had very little knowledge about what caused that, it must have been so difficult to come to terms with, not having any theories about disease and so on. And the funeral, of course, would have been one of the ways that you would have come to terms with a loss like that. And work like this is going to really change the way that we look at Anglo-Saxon graves and at how the funeral has resulted in the grave. It makes me think that when I first began working on material from cemeteries, we used to use the body and the grave as a proxy for living people, because living people in the early Anglo-Saxon period were almost invisible to us. Now, with the DNA analysis, we can look at them on their own terms. We can look at them as the people that they actually were, and potentially we can get so much more understanding out of them.
It yet again just shows how archaeology can connect people on an emotional level with people from the past, just as much as it can with science and data and things like that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Now, moving on. At the weekend, Time Team published our latest episode on YouTube called Broughton Castle, Secrets Within the Walls. And in it, Susanna Lipscomb takes you on a unique tour of the medieval fortified manor house to reveal some of the hidden features that help tell its remarkable story.
It's a place that's very close to the heart of Time Team's chief metal detectorist, Keith Westcott. He is responsible for the discovery of a huge Roman villa nearby and has kept a close eye on the site ever since. Hello, Keith.
Good to see you.
Why is Broughton Castle so special then?
Broughton's an interesting place because it was built where you've got three different streams coming together, which seemed a good idea to put a moat in that position. It was built at the beginning of the 1300s with Robert de Broughton. It's got a fascinating history where the Fiennes family have been there for many, many centuries, really, since the sort of middle of the 1400s.
And how surprised have you been with the secrets that Broughton Castle and the wider area have been hiding?
It's a very interesting landscape because it sits not too far away from a big Iron Age fort and Roman settlement. And when you sort of come across, sort of east across the estate, there's all sorts of secrets still out there. It takes you through from sort of Bronze Age times onwards, you know, 3,500 years.
You and I have been there, haven't we? I remember you taking me around and showing me some of the sites, and we looked at Broughton Castle, and we also looked at the site that you discovered, this Roman villa site, which is right nearby, and you almost reenacted how it happened. So go on, how did you discover that villa?
Well, it was all based around the position of a sarcophagus burial, and I was sort of fascinated by, you know, why would this lady who was buried in 3rd, 4th century. She was of quite slight build, about 5 foot tall, early 30s. Why would she be buried in the sarcophagus in the middle of a field? And I think the thought it could be close to the settlement, it'd be close to a Roman road, so a potential roadside burial. But for me, it was just too far from both those scenarios, really. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought, I think she's buried there because of her dwelling. You know, she was close to her residence. So I was so convinced in the end that I went out searching. And lucky for me, I've been watching Time Team since the 90s and certainly Stuart when it comes to landscape archaeology. And I'd learnt so much. So really, I didn't go with a metal detector. I went there with armed with basic sort of landscape archaeology principles of looking for changes of topography, you know, availability of water. I thought within perhaps 3 or 4 hours I might get some clues, but actually within 20 minutes it was there in front of me. And when you were looking for it, it was obvious.
And what did it feel like to get the whole of Time Team involved? I mean, it's a huge thing that descends upon a field, isn't it, when you bring Time Team in?
Oh, yeah. Well, it was quite enormous, over 100 people there. The biggest concern for me, I'd been working for months to try and get it all set up, and we found only 2 weeks before we were starting that the fields were full of turnips, so I had to go to the landowner and to the tenant farmer and say, I'm afraid you're going to have to plough all of these in again. So that was very difficult for me. But it was a fantastic feeling because, of course, as I said, I've been watching Time Team since the 90s. I've been using sort of techniques that I've learnt with Time Team. And, you know, that helped me discover what is, you know, one of Britain's largest Roman villas.
Well, it's wonderful that you did that because we've got all this knowledge now about the area, and you're suggesting maybe there are more secrets that it still has to reveal as well. Keith, keep doing what you're doing because we need more people like you, I reckon. And thank you for coming on.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Keith. And don't forget, you can watch Broughton Castle Secrets Within the Walls ad-free by joining us as a Time Team member on Patreon.
Now, a couple of weeks ago, you might remember that I was on the Mapperton Estate in Dorset. I joined Time Team's X crew as they filmed an episode searching for what could be the lost site of a Roman building of some sort. That was all brought about by the discovery of Roman roof tiles in a field decades ago.
One of the questions archaeologists get asked quite a lot is, how do you know exactly where to dig when excavating a site? And a lot of the preliminary work to determine what might be hidden beneath the soil is done by geophysics. And if you don't know what geophysics is yet, it's a series of techniques that are used to scan an area of the ground for differences. So those might be differences in magnetic response or in resistance or in radar reflections, and to analyse the responses that come back.
Yes, and in the deep, dark winter months, Time Team's Derek Pittman and Lawrence Shaw, along with students and academics from Bournemouth University who were working on the project, went out to Mapperton to put the technology to the test.
We're off.
We're off.
It's lovely weather for a survey. So we're stood right where the finds were found, right?
Yes.
And it's a funny location. I don't think I'd expect necessarily to find a building here.
No. So there's a lovely little plateau behind us there, which seems like it's been modified and shaped. Big old rise behind us there. But I kind of want to leave them to do the survey, but it's so cold, I might actually help out.
Yeah. Try and warm up.
Yeah. Nick.
Hello.
You guys are well underway. It looks hard work.
Yeah, it's pretty. The topography is pretty up and down, so yeah. There's quite a bit of stone knocking around on the surface and around the field boundaries. All sort of seems to be the kind of local limestone, to be honest, but nothing else. I haven't found any other giant tiles.
No more tiles. Well, we keep looking. I had a route around the trees down there to see if there's any artifacts or anything like that, and I thought I'd found a bit of ceramics, but I gave it to Derek and he subsequently lost it, so awkward.
Well, hopefully you can retrieve it again. Well, but yeah.
It was, just to say, all the important evidence is pinning on you guys.
Okay, all right. No problem. Well, we'll try our best. I mean, yeah, there's high potential for it to work, so yeah, we'll see.
Good luck. Fingers crossed.
Oh, Nick, what horrible weather. How did it go?
You all right?
Not too bad. Yeah, we got there in the end.
I know you've not downloaded the data to look at it yet, but is there any sense of things going on out there?
Well, not... Yeah, it's difficult to say at the moment. I think the landscape looks like pretty good for it, but it's just, we need to go home and process the data properly, really. But, yeah.
So let's say, hypothetically, you've got a lovely magnetometry plot that shows a big, kind of fluorescent blob in the middle, right where we want it to be. What's the next step?
So hopefully we'll find a big anomaly that probably it'll be relatively strong if we've got any burning or anything like that and any ceramic material, which hopefully we have based on the finds that have come up from that field. If we do find that, often it can look like a big blob of magnetic response, if you like. So we could do other techniques, so we can use ground penetrating radar to try and get a better idea of the kind of structural layout.
So if there is a building there, radar's the one that will give us a foundation.
Yeah, generally, earth resistance can also do a pretty good job, but on a day like today when it's pretty wet, neither of those techniques are going to be ideal. But,
Well, in that case, I should let you pack down and get
back
in the water.
Cheers, Nick. See you later. Cheers.
And Derek Pittman's with us now. Derek, it looked absolutely freezing, and it sounded as if it was incredibly windy.
It was probably one of the bleakest days of fieldwork I can remember in a very long time. It was the field itself is quite exposed, so there's no hiding from the wind up there. And the rain was coming in droves here and there. The geophysics crew, Nick and Evan, did an amazing job of pushing through it and persevering through it. Lawrence and I can take very little credit on the day, really, other than being there, introducing them to a landowner, and then hiding in a van for half an hour while they got on with things.
I don't blame you at all. Now, I saw that strange looking car, that contraption being wheeled around the field. What techniques were you using? What geophysical techniques were you using on the site?
So we were using magnetometry, although technically gradiometry, which uses the Earth's magnetic field to identify things under the soil. And you'll notice in that video, it had four sensors, I think, on the day. And each one of those has two magnetometers in it. And as they go over something that influences the Earth's magnetic field, they wibble ever so slightly. John will probably tell me off for saying wibble. I'm sure there's a more technical term.
It's a technical term.
but because we're looking for kind of near surface stuff, and we've got two, the bottom one tends to wibble more if it's close to the surface than the top one. So we can kind of filter out geological background and hopefully see archaeological features just near the surface.
Well, that is clever. It's amazing what geophysics can do. So why did you choose that technique? Why was it magnetometry or gradiometry and not anything else?
Initially, obviously, we had the kind of dot on a map where the farmer had pointed out where he found these incredible tiles. So we sort of had an area to target. But the benefit of that technique, particularly when you've strapped it to a cart and you've got free labour in the form of a student and Nick. It's quite a quick technique. You may have noticed in time teams in the past, clips of it being strapped on the back of a quad bike and whizzed around a field. We were not whizzing on the day, I'll be honest, but it did mean we could cover the field in a fairly short space of time. Ultimately, we were looking for some sort of building potentially because we had tiles. That's the assumption or the hypothesis we were working under. And arguably, it's not the best technique for finding architectural remains. But when you've got things like tiles, which can be quite magnetic, and you've got things perhaps like robbed out foundations or pits or burning, it's very good for finding that very quickly. So given we didn't have that much time to do it, we took that one down with a mind, I think, to if we saw something interesting in the data, we could do something like resistivity or radar, which is a bit slower and a bit more focused, but we could do that at a later point in a more targeted fashion.
You mentioned the students. Of course, this was a project that involved students from Bournemouth University. How important is it that archaeologists of the future, and I suppose also geophysicists of the future, get the chance to do something like this and kind of get their hands dirty on a real site?
It's massively important. And I mean, you'll see almost every commercial unit in the country has a geophysics wing, has a geophysics aspect of their unit. One of the best things about geophysics, obviously, is it's non-invasive. So we can do quite a lot of it. And it means sort of every year we have Nick Crabb, my colleague, runs a geophysics unit where he gets 10, 12 students every year having a go at it. And then quite often those students will go on to do it for their dissertation. So at that point, we tend to want to find them a real site that will contribute to knowledge so that we're not just sending them out to do an exercise in a field. It's having that kind of element of discovery in a way hopefully gets them the bug of why geophysics is such a cool technique and why you might want to go and work on it in future. So having opportunities like the one at Mapperton where there's a very open landowner who's very keen to have work done and there's a little smoking gun of a target, it's a great opportunity for Evan and his project.
Now, Derek, how much can you tell us about what the results were like? What could you actually see there?
That is a great question, and I'm going to tiptoe a fine line here because I don't want to give away too much because obviously we've as regular listeners and viewers will know, we've gone back and done a few days there now. The data showed something. It showed a very clustered group of anomalies around the point where the artifacts were found, and some of them had a little bit of a linear character. I had a good chat with John via WhatsApp to try and interpret the data. And as with every professional proper geophysicist, and I would consider John proper, me an amateur, he just said, I need more data. I need more figures. I need the traces. I need more details on this plot. I can't possibly say anything from this alone, but it does look like there might be something there. To my eye, I could see some sort of rectangular-esque structure in amongst some blobs.
So it does look like there might be something there. That you heard it here first, folks.
I think there was enough there for me to get very excited on a personal level, and for the team at BU to get very excited. And also, I think just enough there to get Time Team excited to go and do a bit more work.
That's absolutely marvellous to hear, Derek. I look forward to seeing the actual plans, the actual plots in the near future. But for now, thank you very much for coming to share that windy, rainy, blustery and freezing cold day with us.
This is the Time Team Podcast with Helen Geek and Martin Williams, where we bring the world of archaeology to life. And that happens on an even greater scale for Time Team members over on Patreon.
Our members are the lifeblood of what we do here at Time Team, providing us with the support and, crucially, the funding to go out on more excavations to discover the world beneath our feet.
And to say thank you, Time Team members get access to all sorts of additional content, including ad-free and bonus episodes of the podcast. There's 3D models, masterclasses, and a chance to join us on digs up and down the country.
For more on the benefits you can get by being a Time Team member, head to patreon.com/timeteamofficial.
Okay, let's delve further into some of the archaeology stories making news around the world now. And I want to tell you about a cave in Pembrokeshire. What archaeologists have found there could, some experts say, rewrite Britain's prehistory. Small digs have been taking place in Wogan Cavern under Pembroke Castle, where researchers have uncovered extremely rare evidence of early humans and animals, including the bones of a hippopotamus, which roamed Wales 120,000 years ago. The plan now is for a much larger five-year dig run by the University of Aberdeen, which is going to start in May.
It's so rare to find this kind of deep prehistory site like this in Britain because of our northern location. So much of what we once had has been removed, kind of scrubbed out by glaciers in the ice ages. And those rocky caves, they're not typical of most of the country. So wow for this one. Not only evidence for animals, but evidence for human activity too. And every time a site like this is discovered, which is probably a couple of times a century, you know, they are really rare. They bring on our knowledge in such a great leap. And I think that's why people are saying, you know, rewriting history. It's a bit of a cliche, but this one is going to be really remarkable. And I cannot wait to see what they find.
We definitely need to investigate that one further than I reckon on the podcast. So watch this space. Next to ancient Egypt. And I think if you asked anybody, well, anywhere in the world really, to tell you something about ancient Egypt, they would probably go pyramids and then they'd probably mention mummies. Well, archaeologists from the University of Barcelona have found a papyrus copy of Homer's Iliad, which is a poem about the Trojan War, in the gut of an ancient Egyptian mummy. It's the first time ever that a Greek literary text has been found kind of, I guess, incorporated into the process of preservation.
Yes. Now, this was put into the mummy as part of the embalming process. But when you say ancient Egypt, Martin, it's kind of not really an ancient Egypt. It's actually in Roman period Egypt. And in fact, it dates to around 400 AD. So that's miles later even than Cleopatra. And it's when other places in the Roman Empire, like Britain, were really falling apart. So the Iliad, that piece of Greek literature, that would already have been known for over 1,000 years. It was already an old, old poem. And although it's not unusual to find pieces of papyrus that are used to pack the abdomen, if you like, of a mummy when the mummy was being created, this wasn't just something like scrunched up scrap paper. Those papyri, they were carefully chosen for what was written on them. And they are usually, apparently, magical texts that mean something in the context of death. So why use a copy of the Iliad? And what is that going to tell us, firstly, about the history of the Iliad? Because I bet there are loads of classicists who are absolutely fascinated by this because it's a very early text. But also, what does it tell us about the person? There is so much more to learn.
You think we've discovered all there is to discover about ancient Egypt, such as the level of research, but it's just the gift that keeps on giving, isn't there? I love it. Finally, I thought I'd bring you this story. It relates to genetics and DNA, which of course we've been talking a lot about recently after our amazing Cherington princely burial discovery. And this one's of particular interest to you if you have red hair, because a large genetic study has revealed that in Europe, the gene for red hair has been actively selected for more than 10,000 years. So it suggests that either having red hair could have been beneficial to our ancestors, that's one possibility, or that there was some other beneficial trait that had a byproduct of having red hair. I just think it's just so interesting.
It is, isn't it? It's a study that's been led by Harvard University. And the red hair thing is absolutely fascinating. It's long been thought that as soon as a mutation for really white skin, which often goes along with red hair, as soon as that arose in a population in Northern Europe, it would be very quickly selected for, because Northern Europe's got so little sunshine. And if you have darker skin that protects you from sunburn, it also stops you making vitamin D. So in theory, the idea was that this should be selected for very quickly. But now we've got hard evidence that it actually did spread very fast, and that this was just part of a much, much bigger study into huge amounts of DNA, ancient DNA, to show how natural selection has changed the human genome over the last few thousand years. As we've been moving from what you might call a natural human lifestyle that humans are kind of broadly adapted to, so that's hunting and gathering in the rural African environment where we evolved. Now that we have a more modern lifestyle of agriculture and urbanism, and of course living all around the globe from the north to the south, we used to think, the traditional idea is that we invented ways to help us survive. So we invented warm clothing, and we invented sunscreen, and we invented things to carry things in, and so on. We have culture instead of evolution. But actually, this is showing that, almost in a way unsurprisingly, we are still evolving, and we have evolved. And if you think about it, living in a town is one of the most dangerous things you can do. Childhood diseases, if you don't have modern medicine, childhood diseases spread so fast in towns. And so even a tiny evolutionary advantage that helps you fend that off can really quickly be magnified and can cause a big change in a population. Anything that kills you before you have children yourself, especially something that's very virulent and kills a lot of people, like the Black Death, you'd think would have changed human beings, but we can now measure it, we can now see it, we can now prove it. So even something as recent as the start of tobacco smoking, as long as it changes who manages to have how many children, that can play its part in evolution. It is remarkable, isn't it?
It is remarkable. I heard as well that people's thumbs these days, that there's a chance that they could evolve different thumbs because of all the texting that we do.
Are you saying that people who can text more quickly are going to have more children? Because that's the only mechanism. Who knows? Yeah.
I think the more I think about that, the more I don't want to think about it. So we'll maybe leave that to one side. That is it from Time Team News. We are going to keep bringing you more of this sort of stuff, more amazing discoveries from around the world and to do with archaeology, all of that on the Time Team podcast.
Now, I love researching my family history, and I'm quite lucky in that one of my ancestors is relatively famous. On my mother's side, I'm descended from a man called Ephraim Beecham, who was a master mason on St. Paul's Cathedral when it was being built in the early 18th century. And he was responsible for the southwest quarter of the dome, which is, I believe, one of the best bits of that building. And I have realised, of course, that having a famous ancestor makes it a bit easier to trace the links between you and them. So I have really enjoyed looking at that. But what about you, Martin? Do you know anything about your family history?
I mean, I know a little bit. My uncle has done an awful lot of work on this. And so we've got lots of sort of military service records, things like that. And I think at some point in my ancestors' past, a lot of people made hats in Luton. It was just a lot of people making hats. So that's pretty much all I know.
So you are a Mad Hatter? I think you must
be. Evidently.
Well, there are lots of tools out there to help with research that you might be doing. And one of them is The Genealogist. Now, they're not a sponsor, but Time Team has used some of their excellent mapping data in our programmes. And that's what we wanted to talk about on the podcast. How you can use maps to help research your family tree. Because The Genealogist has a great tool to help you.
Yeah, it does. And Mark Bailey is the founder of The Genealogist and is here to explain how it works. Hello, Mark.
Hi there, Martin. Hi, Helen.
Explain, Mark, why do you think so many people are interested in researching their family tree? Because it is a bit of an obsession for some people, isn't it?
I think the main sort of excitement grew when the first census came live. It just became much more accessible. much more economically friendly. Obviously, you're not having to pay for petrol and days off. You could literally just do it on an evening on your laptop at home. Each generation, it's kind of like an exponential growth in terms of number of ancestors you have. Obviously, two parents, you've got four grandparents, eight great-grandparents, and it just, that number gets huge before you know it, just within a few generations. People say, you know, when do you know you stop researching your family history? And the fact is, you never really have, because there's always more records to search on.
This is it. This is when it becomes an obsession, isn't it? So another thing, another tool you could use to further that hobby, further that interest and research, is the Map Explorer tool, isn't it, on the genealogist? So explain a little bit about how you could use maps to understand your family history a bit better.
Map Explorer is a tool we developed because we have so many map-based records. It's what we're known for as a genealogy company. We were the first sort of website to start producing records other than your census BMDs. We started investigating what are tithe records, which are really interesting documents. A tithing, for those of you that don't know, it's where you gave a tenth of your produce to the local clergy. So that had been going on for centuries. But in 1836, the government decided to move to a more a monetary system, something easier to maintain. It meant the government produced a nationwide survey of every parcel of land that was a tithable parcel of land, which meant that they would record what that land is used for, but also the land owner, the land occupier, how large that land is in acres, rods and perches, and then how much tithe rent to be paid on that parcel of land. It doesn't just cover the land owners, it covers the occupiers of those parcels of land.
Well, that sounds amazing, Mark. But can you demonstrate how it actually works?
To launch the tithe maps, we had to build an image viewer. Soon after that, we realized that it makes much more sense for genealogists if we can give someone geographical context. So it's all very well and good in seeing an ancient tithe map, but be able to see that on top of modern day mapping just means that you know exactly where that parcel of land is. So this is where Map Explorer comes in. So I brought up an example today to show you Stonehenge being an archaeological site. Here you can see on the left a control panel that allows us to adjust different things. So in the record set layer on the left, you can see I've just selected the 1836 tithe apportionments. If we click on that, you can see actually it covers all sorts of different interesting record sets. The first nationwide, like I say, map-based record set that is available online is the tithe records. And if we zoom in, what I've got loaded here is a historic ordnance survey map. We can see this is from the 1890s. On top of this map, you can see there's these red icons, these pins. This is all interactive. So this is displaying our record set layer. So this is our tithe apportionments in this case from 1836. The landowner here is Sir Edmund Antrobus Baronet. And then from here, we can view the transcript and see the full details. But you can see, jump to the original tithe map itself. So you can see in 1836, it's not quite as detailed as Ordnance Survey's kind of level of standard for street level mapping. But for the majority, they're this kind of quality where they're good enough to see exactly where your ancestors' field was. And in this case, you can see Stonehenge. And like I say, you can click on any pin and you can see the landowner and land occupier. So that's 1836. You can also view transcript, and then from there you can view what we call the apportionment books, which will then go into detail telling you what that land was used for, where that land was situated, like the address, and obviously the amount of tithe rent to be paid.
Helen, I can see Stuart Ainsworth having an absolute field day here.
Yes, because not only do you do you see, I mean, it's astonishing at Stonehenge, where we're used to seeing this really big open landscape, because it's been restored to try to get it back to a kind of more prehistoric feeling, but that it was divided up into fields in the 19th century. But so not only can we see those field boundaries, which of course Stuart gets from maps as a matter of course, but the fact that you can see who owns them means that you can see who's doing the same thing in the same field, so to speak. You can see the estates, you can see the ownership patterns. It will have implications for archaeology that property boundaries are some of the most fossilizable aspects of a landscape, and they're often not visible from maps which are just concerned with physical features.
From there, you can see each parcel of land has got a number, so you can follow those pins across, keep clicking, and see the ownership moving across. So for those that are researching their ancestors, you can find your ancestors' property and then see the neighbouring property, see if they own those neighbouring fields or who your ancestor lived next to. You can time travel as well. So from 1836, I can then jump to 1910, which is another map-based record set known as the Lloyd George Domesday. So if I click on view map on this case, you can see this is so much more detailed than the original tithe maps. And you can see each individual stone has been indicated there on the map, and some of the old names of the stones, you know, from way back. So you've got the Slaughtering Stone and Friar's Hill. But again, you've got these pins that tell you the ownership of that property. So I thought it'd be interesting to show you the details from 1910. So if we zoom in to the original records themselves, it says, you know, Stonehenge, Amesbury is the address. And in 1910, they noted the description as an ancient monument. In 1915, there was an amendment, and they decided to rename these as historical stones.
Mark, it's such an interesting tool, and I can see how it would be so useful if you're researching your family tree. If people want to find out a little bit more about how they can use this tool and the other services that the genealogist provides, what do people need to do?
Well, we've got a special offer for Time Team viewers. They can visit thegenealogist.co.uk/TT26, and they can get a 14-day free trial, after which they'll have a 30% lifetime discount. So it works out at $118.95 a year, and each year you stay with us, you'll get that same discount again and again.
Well, Mark, thank you so much for coming on. And like you heard Mark say, there's plenty more at the website, thegenealogist.co.uk.
And that's about it from the Time Team podcast for this week. It's a question and answer episode next week, where I'll be answering questions sent in by Time Team members. You can get yours to me by contributing to the podcast chat at patreon.com/timeteamofficial.
Well, we look forward to speaking to you then on the next edition of the Time Team podcast. Bye-bye.
Bye.